From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Regardless of precision of smart bombs, heavy bombing of Baghdad is certain to cause civilian casualties, as it happened yesterday.
Civilian casualties, smart bombs, weapons of war, suing Bush Sr., Cheney, Powell, and Schwarzkopf. And in New York, today, a day of civil disobedience direct actions. But first, a live report from Baghdad. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Iraqi health minister said today there have been 4,000 civilian casualties, including 350 deaths, since the U.S. invasion began. He also said 36 people were killed in the last 24 hours in the continuing raids on Baghdad. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials have been changing their story on the missile attack on a market in northern Baghdad where 14 civilians were killed. The U.S. Central Command issued a statement to say U.S. aircraft had used precision-guided weapons to target Iraqi anti-aircraft missiles, quote, positioned less than 300 feet from homes. But a few hours later, senior Pentagon official Major General Stanley McChrystal said no coalition aircraft had targeted any air defenses in the Shab district where the blast occurred. Then the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, said, quote, it's just as likely that it's some piece of equipment of theirs as one of ours. Meanwhile, the Globe and Mail is reporting Iraqis in the southern town of Safwan say British troops are shooting at civilians there, including women and children. U.S. forces bombed Iraqi television broadcast facilities in central Baghdad again last night. Iraqi TV signal was restored around midnight. Several hours later, a second wave of bombing was launched, and a witness said the Iraqi TV building was in flames and destroyed. But broadcast resumed in Baghdad this morning with a shaky picture and no sound. A U.S. intelligence official told the Los Angeles Times the strikes reflect a new decision by military commanders to disable Iraqi television for the duration of the war. Meanwhile, in the southern city of Basra, British forces bombed Iraqi state radio and television transmitters, taking both broadcasting outlets off the air. U.S. and British forces have taken over a number of radio frequencies and are broadcasting their own messages to the people. The action comes just after the head of the world's largest journalist organization said the attacks on Iraqi television may violate the Geneva Conventions and called for an international investigation. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera has broadcast footage of the bodies of two missing British soldiers. The British military said it is, quote, shocked and appalled at the release of the pictures and called the broadcast a, quote, flagrant and disgraceful breach of the Geneva Convention. Around 1,000 U.S. soldiers parachuted into Kurdish-controlled territory in northern Iraq early today, opening a northern front in the invasion. The troops will attempt to secure an airfield so cargo planes can deliver tanks and other equipments. It is the largest parachute invasion since the Panama invasion 14 years ago. Soldiers on the northern front will aim to take over oil fields, divert Iraqi soldiers from the south, and provide a buffer between Turkish and Kurdish forces. Plans to send some 60,000 troops to northern Iraq were ruined by the Turkish parliament's refusal to allow U.S. troops on its soil. The U.S. 7th Cavalry Regiment has lost three tanks so far in the large battle south of Baghdad along the Euphrates. It is the first time the heavily armored 70-ton M1A1 Abrams tank has been destroyed in combat. In addition, a bridge collapsed as an M1 tank was crossing a river, and the Army Times is reporting two other tanks rolled into a ditch. One tank had to be abandoned. A convoy of around 100 Iraqi tanks and armored vehicles tried to break out of Basra last night and headed straight towards British positions. British military officials say British warplanes and artillery destroyed most of the vehicles in a fierce overnight battle. 37 Marines were injured by so-called friendly fire when shell and mortar rounds hit a Marine command post near Nasiriya. 6 vehicles were destroyed in the attack, and a second Marine has died from injuries sustained in the grenade attack by a U.S. soldier on Saturday. The Washington Times is reporting 2 Marines drowned in southern Iraq yesterday. Marine Corps Major Matt McLaughlin said, quote, "What we understand is that these Marines were crossing the Saddam Canal and that somehow they fell in the canal." But a Washington Times photographer said the men were ordered into the water while wearing heavy gear. The Pentagon identified the Marines as 20-year-old Corporal Evan James, who was a lifeguard student, and 28-year-old Sergeant Bradley Courthouse, who worked as a plumber. After days of delays, the first humanitarian aid arrived at the port of Umkasar and the southern town of Safwan. But the BBC reports humanitarian officials are saying the distribution broke all the laws. A survival of the fittest order developed with strong young men dominating the area closest to the truck's doors, while old women and small children circled the periphery looking for items that might have fallen unnoticed. One young Iraqi told the Guardian of London, "I do not need this. They bomb, and now they want to give water and food. How can they do both? How?" Meanwhile, efforts by the Red Crescent to distribute aid were disrupted when a load of 45,000 meal packs were hijacked. The UN is expected to announce on Friday a $2.2 billion emergency appeal for what may be the largest humanitarian mission the UN has undertaken. But the Washington Post reports the Bush administration is intent on making it at least appear that the U.S. is offering humanitarian aid first. One senior official said, "We wanted the Iraqis to see the benefit of this liberation as quickly as possible." In Basra, Red Cross workers yesterday helped partially restart the main water supply facility in Basra, but the city is now in its 6th day without electricity. Some senior U.S. military officers are now predicting the war in Iraq will likely last for months and will require considerably more troops and combat power than is now on hand in the Gulf. President Bush yesterday ordered the 16,000 troop 4th Infantry Division to Gulf, as well as 5,000 troops from the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. This news from Iran: the leader of Iraq's main Shiite opposition group warned Washington yesterday that U.S. troops will face armed resistance if they stay in Iraq once President Saddam Hussein has been toppled. The Associated Press reports lawyers have arrived in Iraq to help coalition forces establish martial law in the wake of the invasion. Military officials say they will seek the assistance of Iraqi authorities to establish martial law in, quote, liberated Iraq. The London Independent is reporting U.S. and British soldiers are building an internment camp at a secret location inside Iraq to hold thousands of prisoners of war from Saddam Hussein's forces. So far, they have not disclosed the location even to the Red Cross, which has a right under international law to visit prisoners. Earlier this week, General Tommy Franks claimed coalition forces have taken about 3,000 Iraqi prisoners of war. The U.S. Air Force announced the removal of 4 top commanders at an Air Force academy in Colorado Springs. There have been several allegations of the routine rape and sexual assault of female cadets at the school. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan has died at the age of 76. And while the Pentagon says this is not a war about oil, troops in Iraq appear to understand otherwise. The Washington Post reports that U.S. troops recently named 2 temporary refueling facilities. Their names: Camp Shell and Camp Exxon. And finally, 2 Nobel Peace Prize winners were among 60 people arrested near the White House during an anti-war protest yesterday. Police handcuffed Mairead Corrigan McGuire and Jody Williams when they refused to leave Lafayette Park and across the street from the White House. Also arrested at the protest was Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg is best known for leaking the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret Defense Department study on the Vietnam War.
Another day, make your voices roar. Stop. to do is listen.
Stop the War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jeremy Scahill, just back from Baghdad. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, U.S. forces bombed Iraqi television broadcast facilities in central Baghdad again last night. There has been universal condemnation of this act. Just at a press briefing, we were watching a Pentagon press briefing. One of the reporters once again asked the U.S. military, saying with Amnesty International's condemnation and others, why did they do it? And they said they see it as a legitimate military target. We're going to go right now to Baghdad. Live report from independent journalist Mei-Ying Welsh. Welcome, Mei-Ying.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what you know of the bombing of the TV station? And then we want to ask you about the Iraqi health minister saying there have been 4,000 civilian casualties, including some 350 deaths since the invasion began. But first, what you understand about the second bombing of the television station in Baghdad?
Well, we're not allowed to go and take a look at the building. It's right actually next to the Ministry of Information, and yet we can't just take a walk just a half a block away and take a look at the destruction. I can tell you that Iraqi TV is still on. It's on quite shakily, but it can still be seen, and it's being used by the government here to deliver a lot of different messages to the people. I can talk a little bit about that later. About an hour ago, there was a really major bombing here, very close by to where we are standing. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the Ministry for Military Industrialization, which, from where I'm standing, is behind the Foreign Ministry. A huge, huge cloud of black smoke went up from there, and there was a lot of anti-aircraft fire coming straight off of buildings right next to me. And we've had some more scares with, you know, more bombings around here, with journalists running off of the roof of the ministry and down into the parking lot, because we're all afraid that at any minute our building could be hit, the building we work out of, the Ministry of Information, which is also could be considered by the U.S. Forces a legitimate military target, because, I mean, every day ministers come here and deliver the Iraqi point of view about how this war is going. They tell us about civilian casualties. They talk about how their forces are doing. They dispute the notion that a lot of these so-called accidents that are happening with U.S. troops falling off a bridge, or a helicopter falling out of the sky, or a tank being blown up, are just friendly fire incidents or accidents or something. They say that their forces have taken out all of these different forces of the U.S. and they give very specific dates and times and information even about who destroyed a particular tank, what their name is, how old they are. And so they feel like they've been giving us an alternative view about what's going on in this war, and that the U.S. forces want to try and shut that up.
And the health minister, the estimates of casualties.
Right. The health minister gave a press conference today and for the first time said that gave us a total number of civilian casualties and dead for all of Iraq. But he stressed that these aren't final figures. They're still trying to figure it out themselves. As you said before, 4,000 injured, 350 dead. He also specified how many people were injured yesterday at a Shav neighborhood here in Baghdad. He said 15 killed, 44 injured. And he said that yesterday in Basra, another 13 were killed and 51 injured. He said that the U.S. forces are deliberately targeting power, water, and sewage systems in Basra, leaving the city dark and without water. And he accused the U.S. of using cluster bombs indiscriminately in all the governorates of Baghdad.
Last night I was watching General Peter Pace, who's the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was being interviewed by Larry King. And he was asked by Larry King about this attack on Al-Shabaab area in the market that you were just describing. And he said, well, Larry, it wasn't on our target list, I can tell you that, but I can see that it's possible that a number of things might have happened. One is that one of our missiles failed to, quote, perform. The second would be that it was an Iraqi surface-to-surface missile that was intended to be fired at U.S. forces outside of Baghdad that Peter Pace said fell short of its target. And the third was that it could have been an Iraqi surface-to-air missile. You were at that scene yesterday. Describe what it looked like on the ground in the Al-Shabaab market.
Well, there were two holes in the ground which had been partly shoveled over with dirt. They had removed any missile fragments or anything, so we weren't able to find out. We weren't able to take a look at the missile fragments. I asked the minister, a person from the Ministry of Information, you know, why don't you leave the missile fragments there so we can take a look at it and determine, try and determine anyway, so where this missile came from. And he said, because we think that they're toxic, and so we removed them so that they won't contaminate the area and contaminate the people, because we don't know if they have depleted uranium on them. So we weren't able to see, you know, to see for ourselves what exactly it was that hit the neighborhood. And even the place of impact had been sort of shoveled over with dirt. So, you know, it's really hard for me to say what kind of missile hit the area. There were supposedly two of them. But, you know, I can't confirm anything because we weren't able to see those things.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of the television station, the outcry of human rights groups saying that this is a civilian target. Can you talk about what goes on inside the TV station? And can you talk about the distinction between bombing a transmitter and the television station itself? Do you know if people were inside and killed?
Well, I'm sure there were people there, because 24 hours a day there are people at Iraqi radio and television. They have a radio show that plays nothing but American music and takes requests from young people about what they want to hear, Celine Dion, Britney Spears, whatever it is. And they have TV programming going on all night. So, you know, they have talk shows going on at night, all kinds of things. So definitely there were people in the building. And I'm sorry, I couldn't understand your first question. I couldn't hear you.
I think the question, Mei Ying, is they say they've bombed Iraqi television, and yet Iraqi television is still on the air, according to what you and others are reporting. And we were asking about the difference between bombing a television station and bombing a transmitter. For instance, in Serbia in 1999, during the NATO bombing, when the U.S. attacked Radio Television Serbia, RTS, Radio Television Serbia, covered its own bombing because the United States had attacked the studio where people work and where people are around the clock. They did not attack the transmitter, and that appears to be what they've done now in Baghdad.
Yeah, I mean, because it is still transmitting, and it's been transmitting all through. And as you said, it doesn't look very good, and it doesn't sound very good, but it's still there. And I was told by Iraqis from the Ministry of Information that they have a secondary way of getting that signal out. So, yeah, they bombed the building where the people work, but the Iraqi television is still on air.
And are you able to hear it as well as see the image? The reports here are that there is no sound, but that they were able to get up a shaky image.
Well, the last time I saw Iraqi TV was late this morning, and it was extremely staticky. It was very, very loud static, so I couldn't really understand what was going on.
And how are you able to get around Baghdad right now? How bad are the storms? Are the burning oil and the trenches smoke that surrounds the city?
Well, the rain that we had last night really cleared away a lot of that sandstorm and also a lot of the smoke. So we've had pretty clear skies today, but there's still a lot of smoke coming up from those oil fires, renewed smoke. It's not as bad as it was. As for getting around the city, we are able to drive almost anywhere we like. There are no checkpoints. However, you have to realize, as a foreigner and as a journalist, anywhere you drive in the city, you're watched. You know, just sitting down in a restaurant for lunch, I feel very strange because people look at me when I start speaking with my driver, I start talking to him about any little thing. All the ears around me perk up. People are listening to what we're talking about, giving us a suspicious look. I mean, this city is at war now, and everybody's on edge, and nobody sticks out more than a foreigner. And furthermore, nobody sticks out more than a foreign American. So really, it's possible for me to go just about anywhere, but not without everybody wondering who I am, why I'm there, and what I'm doing.
And finally, Mei Ying, we understand that Saddam Hussein has met with the head of all of the heads of all of the tribes in Iraq, and also that leaflets are now being distributed in neighborhoods. Describe what's happening.
Well, all of the heads of all the tribes of Iraq are meeting in Baghdad today to discuss their strategy for this war. They are, the tribes play a very important role in Iraqi society. Every person in Iraq is a member of one tribe or another. And when the tribal leadership sort of makes a decree on that tribe, especially in some of the more rural areas, it would be very difficult for a member of that tribe to refuse. If the sheikh of the tribe said, we have to fight, it would be very difficult for them to say, no, I won't. They have a lot of influence over people. They're sort of like part of the family structure, sort of like a structure above the family. Now, Saddam Hussein also gave a speech to the tribes on Iraqi television before it was hit, urging them to fight. He told them, strike hard. He said, this is your day. You've been looking for such a day. This is it. He said, don't wait for instructions from the leadership. You're the leaders now. He said, hit their convoys. Hit the first car in the convoy and the last car in the convoy so that you kind of bottleneck them in. And he said, kill them wherever you find them. In terms of the leaflets, the highest authority for Sunni Muslims in Iraq, Abdul Karim Biara, Sheikh Abdul Karim Biara, has called for a jihad. And actually, he was on Iraqi television just last night calling for this jihad against America and against U.S. forces to protect the country. And that's a holy war. I mean, it means that really you're not a good Muslim if you don't participate. Also, the highest Shia authority in Iraq, Sheikh Sistani, issued some months ago a fatwa declaring anyone who fights with the Americans or aids them in their fighting against Iraq to be a heretic and who will go to hell. And copies of this order of call for jihad and also of this fatwa have been printed up onto leaflets with pictures of the two sheikhs and are being distributed in various neighborhoods around Baghdad. Cars are being loaded with these leaflets, and then they drive to, for instance, a Shia neighborhood of Baghdad like Al-Hurriya or Saddam City, and just distribute them house to house so that people are in the city are aware, if they weren't already aware, that there's a religious, it's incumbent upon them religiously to fight the Americans.
Well, Mei Ying Welsh, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Mei Ying is on the ground in Baghdad right now, one of the few independent reporters there. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to your next update and be safe. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about smart bombs and high civilian casualties. Stay with us.
The sky is gray, and the sand is gray, and the ocean is gray. I feel right at home in this stunning monochrome, alone in my way. I smoke and I drink, and every time I blink, I have a tiny dream. But as bad as I am, I'm proud of the fact that I'm worse than I seem. And what kind of paradise am I looking for? Yeah, I've got everything I wanted, and still I want more. Maybe some tiny shiny key will wash up on the shore. Through my walls like a ghost on TV, you penetrate me. My little pink heart is on its little brown raft, floating out to sea. And what can I say, but I'm wired this way, and you're wired to me.
Ani DeFranco Gray here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill. An article in yesterday's Washington Post begins, "Breakfast was simple, but late." days of bombing had left the Khalil family sleepless. When a respite arrived at noon today, a moment of ease in an uneasy time, they sat down, picking anxiously at boiled eggs, tomatoes, and bread. 9-year-old Shahid told stories, and her 12-year-old brother Ahmed laughed. The older family members, with harrowing memories of bombings in the 1991 Persian Gulf War, sat uneasily, their silence an eloquent testament to worry. Then a whisper sounded, ever so slight. In seconds, the house was shattered by a cruise missile, the family said. Akil, the mother of five children, and her daughter-in-law, Sahar, were killed. Two sons and a daughter were wounded. Hours later, weary and angry, Akil, the oldest son, looked out at his bandaged siblings laying dazed in their hospital beds. He shouted, quote, "There are no soldiers in my home. There's no gun in my home. How can God accept this?" As civilian casualties mount, we're joined right now by Hadi Gaimi, an independent researcher and former physics professor. He works with the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, let's talk about smart bombs and civilian casualties.
Yes, we have been told much in the media that smart bombs herald a new era of humane weapons that will drastically reduce the number of civilian casualties. However, the evidence that has accumulated from the previous conflicts, including Gulf War I, Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan, points completely in the opposite direction. For one thing, all the information given about smart bombs is rarely mentioned that those properties are on average. That means that there are quite a few of them that do not perform as expected. In the first Gulf War, only one out of three smart bombs worked as expected. During the Yugoslavia conflict, that rose to 50%, or one out of two. In Afghanistan, that is still 75%, which is three out of four. That means that of every four smart bombs dropped, one of them will go wrong eventually, statistically.
You're saying that this is according to the Pentagon's numbers.
Yes, these are assessments, bombing assessments according to Pentagon.
There's two issues. One is, how precise are precision bombs and smart bombs? And the other is, are civilians directly targeted?
Yes.
I want to go back 12 years to a piece by Barton Gellman in the Washington Post, still there. The piece says, the strategic bombing of Iraq, described in wartime briefings as a campaign against Baghdad's offensive military capabilities, now appears to have been broader in its purpose and selection of targets. Amid mounting evidence of Iraq's ruined infrastructure and the painful consequences for ordinary Iraqis, Pentagon officials more readily acknowledge the severe impact of the 43-day air bombardment on Iraq's economic future and civilian population. Their explanation these days of the bombing's goals and methods suggests that the Allies, relying on traditional concepts of strategic warfare, sought to achieve some of their military objectives in the Persian Gulf War by disabling Iraqi society at large. Though many details remain classified, interviews with those involved in the targeting disclose three main contrasts with the administration's earlier portrayal of a campaign aimed solely at Iraq's armed forces and their lines of supply and command. Some targets, especially late in the war, were bombed primarily to create post-war leverage over Iraq, not to influence the course of the conflict itself. Planners now say their intent was to destroy or damage valuable facilities that Baghdad could not repair without foreign assistance. Many of the targets in Iraq's Mesopotamian heartland, the list of which grew from 400 to more than 700 in the course of war, were chosen only secondarily to contribute to the military defeat of Baghdad's occupation army in Kuwait. Military planners hoped the bombing would amplify the economic and psychological impact of international sanctions on Iraqi society and thereby compel Saddam Hussein to withdraw Iraq's forces from Kuwait in a ground war.
Well, I think 12 years later, we see that evidence very clearly. Before the war started, many humanitarian organizations and the United States warned that the first Gulf War has affected the civilian population gravely. We know that the health and nutritional status of the Iraqi population was degraded deeply, and it confirms very much with what you just said, the aims of the bombing in 91, 12 years on, it did indeed produce such a results with regard to the population. We know water, electricity, and sewage were directly hit. That affected the health infrastructure, that affected the food and water distribution systems, and Iraqis have suffered deeply because of that. The question is, are they going to continue doing that with the bombing undergoing at the moment?
Now back to the issue of precision and smart bombs.
Yes.
How precise they are.
Yes, as I mentioned, it really doesn't matter how technically accurate and precise they are, because these are devices which are man-made. And we should still remember that humans are involved in every stage of that process. These are manufactured by humans, so they could be defective, just like you go and buy any electronic devices, and once in a while one could be defective due to manufacturing. So we don't know. These bombs obviously don't get tested beforehand. They could be defective. Second of all, they are given an address or a direction to go to based on information, which is, again, human intelligence. And we know that Americans have a very poor record of collecting human intelligence on the ground. Thirdly, they are operated by a human who could make mistakes in sending them. So that, in addition to all the technical things that could go wrong, has given us a situation where, at best, we have 3 out of 4 of them working. Also, when we look at the accumulated evidence with regard to civilian casualties, we see that the claim of reducing civilian casualties is quite inaccurate. It is amazing that in Kosovo and Afghanistan, the number of civilian casualties produced per amount of explosions used is exactly the same as in Vietnam War, where dumb bombs were used. So there has been no progress with regard to reducing civilian casualties. Also, the fact that these are so precise emboldens the commanders to use more and more of them, which again statistically causes more and more of them to go wrong and cause civilian casualties.
According to whose figures are the is the miss rate?
These are all Pentagon bomb assessments that have been reported in the media, both after the first Gulf War, where only 30% worked, and after the Kosovo War, where less than 50% worked, and last year after their usage in Afghanistan, which only 75% worked. All the numbers come from Pentagon.
We're talking to Hadi Gaimi, who is a researcher with the Center for Economic and Social Rights, a former professor of physics at the City University of New York. We are going in just a minute to Midtown Manhattan, where there is a mass civil disobedience that is taking place. And we're going to hear right now from the streets. Hi, can you identify yourself? Tell us where you are and what's happening.
Hi, my name is Kim Flynn. I am at the corner of 50th and 5th Avenue, across from 5th Avenue. And what is now happening, well, what happened 10 minutes ago is that a legal picket of more than 300 demonstrators moved into the streets for a mass die-in. There were many, many people lying down on 5th Avenue. Traffic is completely blocked. There are many, many news cameras. There are also many, many police. At this point, riot police have come through, and they are now encircling those who are still lying in the street. My guess is that they're going to begin to haul people off. People have gone limp, so it looks like the people who are in the street right now are not going to move willingly.
Can you tell us why you're there?
We are here because we want to express our moral outrage about this unjust and illegal war, and especially our solidarity with the civilian population of major cities in Iraq who are now clearly under attack. People were bombed at a marketplace yesterday. This has to stop, and we, the activist community of New York City, and this group is many, many, many groups. It's more than 35 groups. We watch the towers fall. We know what it is to have our city come under attack. And we will not stand by and say nothing with the implication that somehow we consent to this terrorizing and attack on civilians in cities in Iraq.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll be going back to the demonstration through our 2 hours of programming. But staying on the issue of civilian casualties, we're going to go now to Belgium. Iraqi civilians are still trying to obtain justice over the first Gulf War. Last week, a group of Iraqis sued Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State General Colin Powell, former U.S. President George Bush Sr., and retired U.S. General Norman Schwarzkopf. The lawsuit was filed by 7 Iraqi families over the bombing of a civilian bomb shelter in Baghdad that killed 403 people on the night of February 12, 13, 1991. At the time, Powell served as the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Dick Cheney was the defense secretary. Under Belgian law, courts can try suspects for war crimes regardless of where the alleged acts took place or the nationality of the accused. But the Belgian parliament has just passed a law that could prevent the suit from going forward. Under the amendment, a federal prosecutor can decide in certain cases whether to accept a lawsuit. Reed Brody joins us now from Brussels. He is with Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reed.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Can you talk about this case and what's happening now?
Okay. This case, as you mentioned, is brought because of the bombing of a civilian air raid shelter during the first Gulf War. It was the single incident that produced the highest death toll in that war. The victims have come to Belgium and filed a lawsuit against U.S. officials at the time. I've seen the complaint. I don't know the victims. It is an incident that Human Rights Watch, my organization, had investigated in 1991. You may remember that bombing. The U.S. Said that they thought that the shelter was being used as a military command and control facility and targeted it for that reason. Our conclusion at the time was that, at the very least, if the U.S. had made a determination, erroneous as it turns out probably, that it was a command and control facility, at the very least, the U.S. was obliged to give a warning prior to the attack that it no longer considered this to be a civilian facility and that it considered it, therefore, fair game for bombing.
So can you talk about the politics of what's happening right now, whether
well,
this
Belgium
suit can go forward?
Has a very model anti-atrocity legislation that allows Belgian courts to investigate and potentially prosecute the worst atrocities, no matter where they're committed. And a number of important cases have been filed in Belgium, a case against Hissène Habré, the former dictator of Chad, a case against Ariel Sharon, the prime minister of Israel, for the his role in the massacre in the Shabra and Shatila refugee camp in Lebanon 20 years ago. Because the law has made Belgium a magnet for these cases, there's been a lot of discomfort, obviously, in certain political and diplomatic milieu. Although I have to say, it's quite amazing to see here how much public support there is for the law. And there's a coalition government in which the Greens and the Socialists are very much in favor of the law. The center-right parties would like to curtail it, but also agree with the general principles of the law. Now, there was a parliamentary debate this month as to what to do about the law, and this case against former President Bush came right in the middle of that debate and sent the politicians scurrying. And regardless of what one thinks about the merits of the case itself, which is obviously based on an important atrocity, the timing was very bad because the day after the case was filed, Colin Powell said, "Well, look, Belgium nobody's going to be able to go to Belgium anymore. We may have to move the headquarters of NATO from Belgium. And Belgian politicians reacted they're already opposed to the U.S. position on the Gulf, on the war. They've alienated the U.S. on a lot of other issues, or vice versa. And they were looking to stem the damage here. And as a result of this lawsuit, actually, the legislation that is probably going to come out of the current debate will be much more restrictive than it would have been otherwise.
Reed Brody, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Reed Brody is Special Counsel for Prosecutions for Human Rights Watch, speaking to us
welcome,
from
Amy.
Brussels. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Dear diary, I'm fiery. Divine winds, my friend, took me back to the beginning when I swore it was the end. From the fiery depths, found the ocean within. My penmanship seals it straight through my lips. I'm hip to your games, hip to the science of war. Propaganda make me fight, but what am I fighting for? My way of life, means and rights, give or take less or more. See through the eyes of the poor, plus I'm black to the core. Ignorance is on tour, booking stadiums and more. The days of Hitler painting pictures, patriotic with gore. You raise a flag on a land, snatch a bald eagle's claw, and stamp the symbol on your currency to finance your war. I'm saying no, not in my name, not in my life, not by my hands, that ain't my fight, not in my name. You wage your war against terrorists and violence, and try to wave your guns of fear and sword in the silence. I'm saying no, not in my name, not in my life, not by my hands, that ain't my fight, not in my name. You built your empire with natives and slaves, like the truth don't resurrect, wage your war from its grave. Got brothers on the sideline, ready for the front line. Tell me when it's my time, won't you tell me? We got women on the sideline, ready for the front line. Tell me when it's my time, won't you tell me? You won't put it in your headline. People are with that line. Do we need a headline? Do we really? We only see what they want us to see. We'll only be what they want us to be. Fighting in their army. We pledge resistance. We pledge to defend civil liberties against social and political repression. We pledge alliance with those...
Not in our name. Saul Williams here on War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. As we go back on the issue of smart bombs and other weapons of war, Hadi Gaimi with us, researcher for the Center for Economic and Social Rights. What about the bombs that they're testing now?
Yes, Amy, there are a number of new weapons that could be used for the first time in this conflict. And there are very little information about their impact on humans or their lethal impact, according to the Pentagon. However, it is not very hard to describe some of them, especially one which is heralded as a major new development, the microwave bomb. We're constantly told it's a bomb that only attacks electronics and disables electronic equipment. However, there is no mention of what happens if there is any humans in the vicinity of that bomb. The way these things work, they are dropped from an airplane and then they detonate at a predetermined height of a few hundred meters, and they embed an entire area of the radius of the order of 500 meters underneath. That means the entire space is filled with microwave radiation, which is something that doesn't have mass, doesn't have odor, doesn't have any indication until someone interacts with it. The intensity of this burst would be very, very extreme, and of course electronics would get fried on its path. The question is what happens to humans? And we're being told they have no effect on humans that is at least deadly. But everybody can refer to their own common experience of what happens when they put a food in their microwave oven. It heats up and it burns. Now imagine if part of a human body is in the path of that microwave, where the amplitude of it is turned up millions of times. It's quite clear that humans will be literally burnt in the path of such a thing, and this would include the entire space around them. And it's amazing how little attention is being paid to that obvious fact.
Also, I think it's important to remember that in the 1991 Gulf War, so-called Gulf War, Iraq was very reluctant to put out any numbers on civilian casualties, only wanting to show those incidents that were extremely brutal and targeting particularly children. But they were also lowering their estimates because of morale, and have since admitted that they did that.
I wanted to shift from these bombs to what's going on now in the South. Hadi Gaimi on the in the studio with us, and Andrew Coburn on the telephone with us. We have this report from Reuters. The leader of Iraq's main Shiite opposition group warned Washington yesterday that U.S. troops would face armed resistance if they stay in Iraq once President Saddam Hussein was toppled. This is a report from Tehran. And then we have other news from the South.
Also, we heard from correspondent Mei Ying Welsh just a few moments ago that the leading Sunni cleric in Iraq has issued a fatwa calling for jihad against any invading forces. And this was meant to coincide with the decree issued by many Shiite clerics last November, saying that anyone who refused to fight or anyone who aided the American forces or any invading forces would be a heretic and would go to hell. We also understand that leaflets are being distributed in neighborhoods, particularly Shiite neighborhoods in Baghdad, as Mei Ying said, with the pictures of the leading clerics and a reminder of the fatwa.
Yes, the idea of foreign occupation by American forces in Iraq, where the holy shrines of Shiites are, is quite disturbing to many people, both in Iran and in Iraq. And really, the Iraqi civilians or population, regardless of Sunni or Shiite, is caught in a very difficult situation. Obviously, they have no love for Saddam. We know they want him to go. But at the same time, it doesn't make sense to them to have him replaced by Americans who have been his main supporter throughout the last 4 decades or 3 decades that he's been in power.
We're also joined on the phone by Andrew Coburn, who is co-author of the book Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein, one of the most extensive pieces of reporting on the uprising that happened after the 1991 Gulf War in the south of Iraq. Andrew, what is your assessment of what's been happening in the south of Iraq? We hear of fighting and resistance in Nasiriya and Basra and Najaf, Karbala. What's your assessment?
Well, it seems to answer the question that people have been asking since Bush and Blair started the run-up to this war, which was how would people in the South particularly react? On the one hand, you know, you have this legacy of resistance to the Baghdad regime and to Saddam, as we saw in the March 1991 uprising, which was a very violent and thing while it lasted, which most of the population joined. And on the other hand, you had, 12 years of very brutal treatment of all Iraqis, but particularly of the southern Iraqis by the sanctions regime. And so southern Iraq, being economically poorer, suffered more than the people in Baghdad did. So, but it seems from what my sense of what we've heard so far is that the notion that the invaders will be met with, showers of rice and, flowers and happy pictures, which is what the Americans and the British told each other and themselves, doesn't seem to have really been borne out so far. I mean, I think what's happening is I don't think we should assume that the population of southern Iraq have a great love for Saddam, but as you just mentioned, then nor do they have much affection for invaders, as the British found out in 1920. So, given that Saddam still seems to be very much in control, I mean, of the cities. He's in control of Basra. He's obviously still fighting for Nasiriya. If I were an Iraqi wondering which way to jump and having no great sort of predilection to jump in favor of the Americans, I'd be sitting tight or possibly joining in the fight against them.
And also, there have been regular problems in particularly in Nasiriya as recently as a few months ago with fighting between forces of the central government in Baghdad and then other sort of undefined groups. But it really is interesting that, for instance, the head of the one of the leading Shiite opposition groups that's backed by Tehran is making these statements that essentially there is not going to be an uprising in Basra.
That's right. He's been making those sort of statements for quite some time, which is why I have it on good authority that Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz did actually say a month or so ago, he said, we're not going to allow democracy in Iraq just so Bashar al-Hakim can be elected president. The Americans are very nervous of each other, these two groups. And, I think it also reflects a nervousness on the part of the Iranians about what's going on. It's not fair to call Syri, the group you're talking about, a wholly owned subsidiary of Iranian military intelligence, but their relationship is certainly close. And I think that, I think this reflects an attitude, not just from this particular Shiite opposition group, but also from the Tehran or some authorities in Tehran about what's going on.
We heard yesterday that British troops have moved to the Iran-Iraq border to disrupt any kind of supplies or help that the Shiites may be getting from Iran. Do you have any information on that in general, how the Iranians are interacting with southern Iraq cities across the border?
Well, I think the Iranians, beyond whatever messages, hints they may be dropping to Bashar al-Hakim, the leader of Syria, I doubt they'd want to get involved any more directly than that. I mean, they were terrified last time in the March 91 uprising. They actually closed the border and didn't allow anyone across to help those who were up, rebelling against Saddam. Whether they will want to get involved in the sense of, you know, allowing support to go over to those fighting the Americans is an open question. I'd be extremely surprised if they did, because that would represent a really major policy decision by Tehran, and I think they really want to sit this one out.
Yes, Hadi.
Also, I want to add, as the fighting goes on around the cities of Karbala and Najaf, it is worth noting that those two cities house very, very important Shiite shrines that are revered both by Iranians and the Iraqi Shiites. And if any damage happens to any of those shrines during this bombing, it could lead to spontaneous outrage in Iran. That is a very critical issue that hopefully the U.S. military is aware of.
In fact, Saddam Hussein rebuilt and has spent quite a bit of money rebuilding the holy shrines at Najaf and Karbala. And in fact, Karbala, when I was there a few months ago, they have a picture of Saddam Hussein and his two sons inside of the office of the imam in that mosque right now.
Well, I want
they probably don't. They don't mention who smashed them up in the first place.
Exactly. Yes.
But it's true that any damage to those shrines would cause a big reaction in Iran, and also it'd be interesting to know if the proto-occupying power, the United States, has given any thought to the fact that there's, you know, normally, and even in the worst of times, you know, there's huge numbers of pilgrims come across from Iran. I wonder if they've, if there's the best and the brightest in Washington as they ruminate on the new empire, if they've thought about that and what they're going to do about it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Andrew Coburn, author of Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein, and Hadi Gaimi, a researcher with the Center for Economic and Social Rights, website cesr.org, and former professor of physics and Iranian-American filmmaker. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we are broadcasting now, hundreds of people are lying in the street in Midtown Manhattan, part of a die-in. Yesterday, at a New York branch of Israel's Bank Leumi in New York, 18 protesters locked together as a human barricade across Fifth Avenue. Covered in fake blood, the protesters lay piled in the street at the foot of a mock caterpillar bulldozer. The act of civil disobedience referenced the killing of U.S. peace activist Rachel Corrie by an Israel military bulldozer in Gaza earlier this month. We're joined right now by Shmulek Rodick, who is a member of Jews Against the Occupation, who participated in yesterday's lockdown and Fifth Avenue. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Can you describe what happened?
Well,
and why the caterpillar bulldozer?
The caterpillar bulldozer is symbolic because the Caterpillar Corporation constantly is providing bulldozers to the Israeli army to do these acts against Palestinian homes. The homes are constantly demolished in the West Bank. What we did yesterday was 16 activists, queer Palestinian Jewish activists from New York City, locked across Fifth Avenue symbolically to stop traffic and bring awareness to the destruction of the Palestinian human rights violations by the U.S.-funded Israeli army.
And what exactly happened to Rachel Corrie with
what happened with Rachel Corrie is that she was murdered by a caterpillar bulldozer by a U.S. by an Israeli military officer.
Caterpillar being the brand
corporation,
name, the corporation,
right, the corporation
that made the bulldozer. How many people were arrested?
There were 17 people arrested, I believe, and they are still in jail at this time.
And we are hearing this as other people are being arrested now in Midtown Manhattan,
right,
overall protesting the invasion of Iraq. Well, speaking of issues Palestinian, they've been described as the Palestinian Cleavers. They were a generous and patriotic family that gave away hundreds of free American flags in Houston after September 11th. They've been publicly supported by their U.S. Congresswoman. They came to the U.S. after fleeing Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War. They've lived an unremarkable life in Houston for 11 years. But that all changed a year ago when armed INS agents dressed in riot gear raided their house while much of the family was sleeping. The father and eldest son were picked up on immigration violations, detained for months. Now they face deportation to Jordan, a country most of the family barely knows. We last heard from the family in September when they were first facing deportation. Overwhelming public support in Houston and around the country led officials in Washington to give them a six-month stay in order for the INS to review their case. Well, now it appears the family is set to be deported again. We're joined by the family's eldest daughter, Noor Kespa, in Houston. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Noor.
Hi, Amy. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. We only have a minute, can you describe your family situation right now?
Yeah, this may be my last chance to implore to people on the airwaves to help my family from possible destruction and devastation. You know, we are being sent to a country that is literally in the middle of a war zone. It's surrounded by two countries that are, you know, at war right now. And I'm asking everyone to contact their senators to co-sponsor the House Bill H.R. 231. There's a House bill that's pending, but the one in the Senate, as you all know, we were supposed to have been deported last year, but due to a Senate bill sponsored by Torricelli and Daschle, you know, it halted the deportation for 6 months. And the bill didn't even get a chance to be voted on. Unfortunately, because of the war, Congress was very busy, and so the bill expired, and INS is now threatening my family with deportation within 24 hours, you know, this Friday. And so we need a co-sponsor in the Senate. I mean, I don't, you know, it's we don't want to waste any more time. We have 24 hours, and nobody is willing to do it except one senator, Senator Sununu of New Hampshire. So if anybody, everybody can just flood his office with letters. We need also leaders, community leaders, church leaders, you know, leaders from all different aspects of the community. You know, Jordan is not our homeland. It's just a place of exile for Palestinians. And if this deportation does take place, this will be the fourth time for my family to be displaced.
Well, Noor Kespa, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll continue to update our listeners and viewers on your case. Noor Kespa speaking to us from Houston. That does it for today's program. If you want to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera. Also, thank you to Elizabeth Press and to Noah Reibel. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. Email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The International Federation of Journalists has condemned the U.S. invasion or the U.S. bombing of Iraq TV as a violation of the Geneva Convention. We'll look at President Bush's $75 billion so-called war budget and look at how it's used to reward allies, often at the expense of the American public. We'll talk to musician Michael Franti about what the U.S. Patriot Act and increased surveillance means for him. And we'll go to the streets of New York, where people, as we broadcast, are engaged in a die-in and being arrested by the scores. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go directly to the streets of Midtown Manhattan, we're joined by Leslie Kielsen, who is in a police wagon, arrested along with about a dozen other people at 49th Street and 5th Avenue. We're also joined in the streets by Seth Gobadan. Let's begin with Leslie. Can you tell us why you're protesting, why you've been arrested?
We are here at Rockefeller Center to protest an illegal war and to protest the major media functioning as a publicity arm of the U.S. government.
And can we hear from Leslie Kielsen inside the police wagon?
Hello?
Hi. Can you tell us where exactly you are?
We're heading down, we're heading, I guess, towards one of the police precincts. We were in the whole huge intersection of 49th Street and 5th Avenue. A whole huge number of people lay down in the middle of the intersection.
Why?
We came to protest the atrocities that are happening in Iraq right now, and my affinity...
Hello?
There's somebody on our van who's got very, very tight cuffs on his hands.
Hello?
And can you talk about why you've chosen that area? Can you talk about why you've chosen that area of Midtown Manhattan as your site for protest?
Hello?
Yes, Leslie, can you talk about why you chose that area of Midtown Manhattan for your site of protest?
We chose Rockefeller Center because there are many, many major media establishments and corporations who stand to profit hugely from this war, and the media has not accurately portrayed what is going on in both in Iraq and also with the anti-war movement here in the United States.
What is your sense of how many people have been arrested so far?
My guess would be hundreds. I'm going to have to get off the phone now.
Thank you for joining us, Leslie Kielsen, a police wagon arrested among a number of other people at 49th and 5th. And as we broadcast, many others are being arrested as well. In the news from the Gulf, U.S. forces opened fire on each other in the worst friendly fire incident in the invasion so far. The two separate divisions stumbled upon each other during a nighttime battle near Nasiriya. Shell and mortar rounds struck a Marine command post. 37 Marines were injured. Three of the wounded are in critical condition, two in serious condition. Six vehicles were destroyed in the attack. Two British soldiers were killed in a separate friendly fire incident yesterday. Corporal Stephen Albert, who was 35, and Trooper David Clark, who was 19, were killed during a battle with Iraqi forces on the outskirts of Basra when their Challenger 2 tank was fired on by their comrades. The Iraqi health minister said today there have been 4,000 civilian casualties, including 350 deaths since the invasion began. He also said 36 people were killed in the last 24 hours in the continuing raids on Baghdad. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials have been changing their story on the missile attack on a market in northern Baghdad, where 14 civilians were killed. The U.S. Central Command issued a statement to say U.S. aircraft had used precision-guided weapons to target Iraqi anti-aircraft missiles, quote, positioned less than 300 feet from homes. But a few hours later, senior Pentagon official Major General Stanley McChrystal said no coalition aircraft had targeted any air defenses in the Shab district where the blast occurred. Then the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, said, quote, "It's just as likely that it's some piece of equipment of theirs as one of ours." Meanwhile, the Globe and Mail's reporting Iraqis in the southern town of Safwan say British troops are shooting at civilians there, including women and children. U.S. forces bombed Iraqi television broadcast facilities in central Baghdad again last night. Broadcast resumed this morning, although there was no sound. British forces bombed Iraqi state radio and television transmitters in the southern city of Basra as well. The action comes just after the head of the world's largest journalist organization said the attacks on Iraqi television may violate the Geneva Conventions and called for an international investigation. We'll have more on that story in a minute. Around 1,000 U.S. soldiers parachuted into Kurdish-controlled territory in northern Iraq early today. The troops will attempt to take over an airfield in the north so cargo planes can deliver tanks and other equipment. Plans to use airfields in Turkey were scuttled when the Turkish parliament refused to allow U.S. to deploy troops there. It's the largest parachute invasion since the Panama invasion 14 years ago. A convoy of around 100 Iraqi tanks and armored vehicles tried to break out of Basra last night and headed straight towards British positions. British military officials say British warplanes and artillery destroyed most of the vehicles in a fierce overnight battle. The U.S. 7th Cavalry Regiment lost three tanks in the battle south of Baghdad. It's the first time heavily armored 70-ton M1 A1 Abrams tank has been destroyed in combat. Another M1 tank was destroyed when a bridge collapsed, and the Army Times reports two other tanks rolled into a ditch. One tank had to be abandoned. Two Marines drowned in southern Iraq yesterday, according to a report in the Washington Times. Marine Corps Major Matt McLaughlin said, quote, "What we understand is that these Marines were crossing the Saddam Canal and that somehow they fell in the canal." But a Washington Times photographer said the men were ordered into the water while wearing heavy gear. The Pentagon identified the Marines as 20-year-old Corporal Evan James, who was a lifeguard student, and 28-year-old Sergeant Bradley Courthouse, who worked as a plumber. After days of delays, the first humanitarian aid arrived at the port of Umm Qasr and the southern town of Safwan. Humanitarian officials on the ground say a survival of the fittest order developed, with strong young men dominating the area closest to the truck's doors, while old women and small children circled the periphery looking for items that might have fallen unnoticed. Red Crescent aid distribution was disrupted when a load of 45,000 meal packs were hijacked. The UN is expected to announce a $2.2 billion emergency appeal for Iraq in what might be the largest humanitarian mission the UN has undertaken. The Washington Post reports the Bush administration is intent on making it appear that the U.S. is offering humanitarian aid first. One senior official said, "We wanted the Iraqis to see the benefit of this liberation as quickly as possible." In Basra, Red Cross workers yesterday helped partially restart the main water supply facility for Basra, but the city is now in its sixth day without electricity. Some senior U.S. military officers now predict the war in Iraq will last 4 months and will require considerably more troops and combat power than is now on hand in the Gulf. President Bush yesterday ordered the 16,000 troop 4th Infantry Division to the Gulf, as well as 5,000 troops from the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. And this news from Tehran: the leader of Iraq's main Shiite opposition group warned Washington yesterday that U.S. troops will face armed resistance if they stay in Iraq once Saddam Hussein has been toppled. The Associated Press reports that lawyers have arrived in Iraq to help coalition forces establish martial law in the wake of the invasion. Military officials say they will seek the assistance of Iraqi authorities to establish martial law in, quote, liberated Iraq. The London Independent is reporting U.S. and British soldiers are building an internment camp at a secret location inside Iraq to hold thousands of prisoners of war from Saddam Hussein's forces. So far, they've not disclosed the location, even to the Red Cross, which has a right under international law to visit prisoners. The U.S. Air Force announced the removal of 4 top commanders at Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. There have been a number of allegations of the routine rape and sexual assault of female cadets at the school. While the Pentagon says this is not a war about oil, troops in Iraq appear to understand otherwise. The Washington Post reports that U.S. troops recently named 2 temporary refueling facilities. Their names, Camp Shell and Camp Exxon. And New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan has died at the age of 76.
Absolutely.
Nothing.
closer to me. Oh, whoa.
War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jeremy Scahill, who's just recently returned from reporting in Baghdad.
Well, Amy, the situation in Basra remains very, very serious, the humanitarian situation, on top of the fact that there's active shelling by British forces. But yesterday, Kofi Annan actually highlighted it and was drawing attention to the fact that many of the people in Basra don't have water. And what the Iraqi government apparently has asked is for the Red Cross to facilitate Iraqi engineers going out to the water plant that they say was attacked to repair it so that water can start coming back into the city. But the British forces are coming up with a counter plan. They want to run a pipeline, a water pipeline, from Kuwait up to Basra because they don't want Iraq to have anything to do with improving situations in Basra. And the Iraqi government has asked the ICRC, the Red Cross, to facilitate some kind of a ceasefire so that they can get clean water back into the city. But the Brits are apparently vetoing it in favor of this pipeline.
Well, we're going to move up from Basra to Baghdad right now. U.S. forces bombed Iraqi television broadcast facilities in central Baghdad again last night. Iraqi TV signal was restored around midnight. Several hours later, a second wave of bombing was launched, and a witness said the Iraqi TV building was in flames and destroyed. But broadcast resumed in Baghdad this morning with a shaky picture and no sound. A U.S. intelligence official told the Los Angeles Times the strikes reflect a new decision by military commanders to disable Iraqi TV for the duration of the invasion. Meanwhile, in the southern city of Basra, British forces bombed Iraqi state radio and television transmitters, taking both broadcasting outlets off the air. U.S. and British forces have taken over a number of radio frequencies and are broadcasting their own messages to the people. The action comes just after the head of the world's largest journalist organization said the attacks on Iraqi TV may violate the Geneva Conventions and called for an international investigation. The International Federation of Journalists said the U.S. bomb and missile attack on Iraqi television on Wednesday was an attempt at censoring and may have breached the Geneva Conventions. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International also condemned the attack on Iraqi TV, saying it might constitute a war crime. A U.S. official in Washington defended the attack, saying the goal is to damage the government's command and control capability. We're joined right now by Aidan White, who is General Secretary for the International Federation of Journalists, which represents some 500,000 journalists in more than 100 countries. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Welcome.
Can you talk about the targeting of Iraqi TV?
Well, I mean, I think we're really concerned about this targeting of the television. I mean, it's not, I have to say straight away, we don't live in a world where we think for one second that this is not heavily biased television. There's no doubt at all about that. But the question is whether or not, under the Geneva Conventions, that the Iraqi television was actually a legitimate military objective and was being used for military purposes. The fact of the matter is that the United States, and this has been referred to in the last few days, was extremely angry about the way that Iraqi television was used to parade U.S. prisoners, and I think rightly so. And there's been a great deal of concern about the sort of propaganda value of Iraqi television. The problem is that under international law, you can't just bomb media if you don't like the message that they're giving out. And the problem is that if you do that, you create the conditions where there's the possibility that any journalist carrying a microphone, carrying a camera on either side of the conflict could be targeted and could suffer as a result. So we're extremely concerned about the implications and consequences of this attack.
Well, it's interesting, too, again, like in the bombing of Radio Television Serbia in 1999, not attacking the transmitter, attacking a place where people are working, a studio.
Yep. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, we feel that the attack that took place against RTS in Serbia a few years ago, which was by NATO, actually did set a very unpleasant precedent. As a result of that, we had attacks on Palestinian radio and TV by Israeli forces, in which they directly quoted the precedent of the NATO bombing at RTS. And now we've also had the problem of the military strike against the Kabul office of Al Jazeera. We've also seen in the conflict between India and Pakistan, again, the targeting of media. And what really concerns us is that we're getting into a situation where it will now be routinely the case that media will be targeted in conflicts, not for because they're being used for military objectives, which was the purpose of the Geneva Conventions, which actually does allow in certain circumstances media to be targeted, but simply because one side regards the work that they're doing as propaganda. And that's extremely dangerous, not just for the people working in radio and television, it's also extremely dangerous for freedom of expression.
This morning at the Pentagon news briefing in Qatar, the Pentagon did say that they did consider the TV station a legitimate military target, talking about it in terms of that issue of command and control.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if that's, I mean, I've got a feeling that does smack of some post hoc justification. The fact of the matter is we were told in the first 2 or 3 days of this conflict that the command and control assets of the Iraqi military were being targeted by coalition forces. And I think it has to be regarded as very strange that 6 days into the conflict, Iraqi television is specifically targeted, and only then after Iraqi television and Arab network television have become a matter of controversy because they were showing U.S. prisoners of war in very distressing circumstances. So I think the justification from the Pentagon now that it was for military reasons, I think, lacks credibility.
Can we talk for a minute about the number of journalists who've been killed at this point, a week into the invasion? You have Paul Moran, who was killed in northern Iraq, suicide bombing. Terry Lloyd, who is with ITV, who was killed in southern Iraq, two members of his crew still missing.
Yep. We are keeping an eye on it. The fact of the matter is we have been following it very closely, and we see that Fred Nerak, the cameraman who was traveling with Terry Lloyd, and their translator, Hussein Osman, are still missing. And we're very disturbed about that. I think there's a real possibility that they are probably casualties like Terry in this conflict. We've also had reports of a Russian journalist going missing and an Iranian journalist who has also gone missing. There are several cases of journalists who've been... Hello?
Yes, we're with you.
There are several cases also of journalists who've been very badly injured. So to date, we're looking at a number of casualties in the conflict, and I fear that with something in the region of 3,000 or 4,000 journalists roaming this region and following the war, that there may be more casualties to follow.
I'm looking at a report from Reporters Without Borders from Montreal. It says the group has written to General Tommy Franks, the commander of the coalition forces operating in Iraq, to ask him to order an immediate inquiry into the exact circumstances of the death of British TV reporter Terry Lloyd,
yep,
of Independent Television News, and disappearance of his French cameraman, Frédéric Nerak, and Lebanese interpreter Hussein Othman on March 22nd near Basra in southern Iraq. Various sources have said they came under fire from coalition forces. The British Defense Ministry said it's opened an inquiry into the death of Lloyd, who was 51. A ministry spokesperson said on March 25th he had no new details and did not want to comment on reports that Lloyd and his colleagues were hit by friendly fire. Reporters Without Borders urged the British authorities to include the disappearances of Narak and Othman in their inquiry. The ITN crew, which was not embedded in any coalition unit and which was traveling in two jeeps marked TV, came under fire at Iman Anas as it was approaching Basra. According to ITN cameraman Daniel Demoustier, who was wounded in the incident, the jeeps came under heavy fire from coalition forces. He said this occurred after they found themselves facing Iraqi soldiers and had turned back. At this point, coalition tanks opened fire on the two vehicles, which took direct hits, he said. They had probably been aiming at the Iraqis, although I am sure the Iraqis were trying to surrender, Demoustier said. They were killed within several minutes, he added. Your comment, Aidan?
Well, I mean, I think we've been following this up very closely. We know that the body of Terry Lloyd, the correspondent from ITN, who was killed in this incident, is in Basra Hospital. And, of course, naturally, his family and friends are very anxious to recover his body. We've been in touch also with Iraqi officials on the question of the tracing the other colleagues who are missing. We asked the British Defense Ministry and the American military authorities also to carry out an investigation. I don't think there's any doubt here from the reports that we've had that this was a so-called friendly fire incident. Daniel Demoustier, who was injured and who actually is the one who gives eyewitness accounts of actually what happened, it's very, very clear that this was fire that actually came from the coalition side. Now, there are in the fog of war, there are going to be terrible accidents, and we've seen, unfortunately, in this war, several of them so far. But it is really very, very important that there is an explanation given as to why this happened, to try to make sure that it doesn't happen again. The difficulty is that there's only 500 or 600 of the 3,000 or 4,000 journalists in this region who are embedded, who have directly the protection of the military. And we're asking that the military authorities, who basically have handpicked who can travel with them, to take account of the fact that given the nature of the story, there are hundreds of journalists around them, and that they have to take account of the fact that these journalists are there and they do need some protection, whether they're embedded or not.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Aidan White, for joining us. From the International Federation of Journalists. And this report that we have on journalists who have gone missing, at least for the moment. Newsday reporter Matt McAllister and photographer Moises Salmon were last heard from Monday evening. Molly Bingham, a freelance photographer, is also missing. There were conflicting reports that Iraqi officials took the three journalists from the Hotel Palestine in Baghdad, telling them they were being expelled from the country, allegedly because of visa problems. But we don't have any information on that at this point, and we will continue to follow it. We come back, a quick comparison between news being covered by Arab media versus information coming from the U.S. media. Stay with us.
The CIA is pushing crack in the ghettos of L.A. while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called the carnivore. While the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor, they're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control? Heroic victory.
David Rovics, who will tell the people? You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio and TV. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Al Jazeera in the last few days has been banned from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and then banned from the floor of NASDAQ. A NASDAQ spokesperson explained the decision in light of Al Jazeera's recent conduct during the war, in which they've broadcast footage of U.S. POWs in alleged violation of the Geneva Convention. They're not welcome to broadcast from our facility at this time. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera running reports that may be angering backers of the invasion. The network's correspondent in Basra claiming there are no signs of a civilian uprising against the regime of Saddam Hussein, a claim that has been often repeated by British and U.S. officials. We're going to talk right now about the difference between the reporting of Al Jazeera and other Arab press and U.S. press. We're joined on the phone by Lama Sandoni, an independent journalist who has been covering the Middle East for 20 years, monitoring the Arab language and U.S. media coverage of this invasion. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Lamas, can you talk about the difference in the coverage?
Yes, actually, there is, especially in this war, there's a big difference. First, I want to point out that it's not just Al Jazeera. There are at least nine other satellite Arabic television networks that are covering this war together with Al Jazeera. And the difference is that the Arab networks are covering American statements. They're giving a lot of airtime for American officials saying the briefs and interviewing American and British officials, in addition to covering Iraq is on the of the of Iraq. So if you
Lamas, if you could repeat what you were saying, we're having trouble with your phone line.
Okay, you're having trouble with the line?
Yes. Go ahead. You can go now.
Okay. I said that in addition to Al Jazeera, there are nine other Arab satellite networks. So it's not only Al Jazeera that's covering the war. And if you're watching Arabic television, what you're going to see is a broader coverage than what you see on American television. So the Arab networks give a lot of airtime to British and American officials, in addition to covering the story on the ground from many places in Iraq as well as across the Arab world and the world. So you will get all of the statements by American officials, the briefings, as well as interviews, and in addition to all of the statements by the Iraqi officials, as well as many interviews with Iraqi civilians. And does and you see the impact of the bombing on civilians and the casualties as well.
Lamis, we're hearing from the so-called embedded journalists from CNN and Fox and all of the major networks and some 500-plus embedded journalists. The characterization is that this operation, yes, it's run into some snags, but that it's going very well, and the U.S. forces are quickly advancing toward Baghdad. They're securing areas throughout the south of Iraq. Yesterday, we heard at the briefing that the Pentagon was saying that essentially Saddam Hussein doesn't control more than 10% of the country. How is what has happened in the south of Iraq, in Nasiriyah, Basra, Qasr, Najaf, Karbala, how is that being portrayed on these media outlets, these Arabic language media outlets that you're talking about?
I mean, even the embedded journalists are if you notice, they're calling it, we're facing obstacles, or elements are giving us giving the troops a headache. They use all kinds of language, but to show that there is some resistance, and some have used the word fierce resistance. The difference is that Arabic television, for example, when American television was reporting that Umm al-Qasr, from the first 12 hours of the war, had been already captured, we knew from Arabic television that it was not captured. Till it was really captured. While American news kept on repeating the propaganda by the British and American forces, and then I would say, oh, there are still pockets of resistance. The Arabic, we knew from the Arabic television that was not yet captured. Amy talked about Basra. When the Brits were talking about an uprising in Basra, Al Jazeera has freed a journalist inside Basra, and we were watching footage from Al Basra, and what the Al Jazeera reported and the other news reported and news outlets reported the statements by the Brits and the claims that there is an uprising. Then they went to their correspondent, who said, "I cannot see any signs of an uprising. This is what I'm watching. I'm watching. They are shelling Al Basra. People are. There's a shortage of water." And he would interview people. So, and he said, if there is an uprising, I'm not seeing any sign of it. So we were getting a more accurate picture from Arabic television, while at the same time they were reporting all of the claims and all of the statements by American and British officials. So I think in the presence of Arabic networks in Iraq in this war has really made the coverage very, very different than the last war. In the last war, I was covering the war from Baghdad, but for the first 10 days, only CNN had a satellite phone, and I was working for the Financial Times and Christian Science Monitor, and CNN would not even allow me to use the satellite phone to even call my parents, let alone file. I had to travel the whole road, which was being bombed by the Allied forces. Took me 24 hours to get to Amman, spend one week there to file my stories and go back. So in this case, first of all, Iraq was more prepared, so there are more journalists who were able to stay and to broadcast. So it's not only the Arabic networks, there are many other journalists. And secondly, because there are many Arab journalists there who speak the language, that we are getting a different narrative. I mean, we're getting a narrative of what it means for a country which has been under siege and under sanctions for 12 years, whose army does not have the comparable sophisticated weapons like the American army, to be attacked and to be invaded. And so it's providing a different narrative that the Pentagon doesn't want. And this is why they're angry with the Arabic networks. I think I have to tell you one thing about Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is known, not only Al Jazeera, most Arabic networks have always showed very graphic pictures of casualties of war, whether they're Palestinians, Israelis, Iraqis, or American soldiers or British soldiers. So it's not sanitized at all. When you're watching Arabic television, you see really the ugliness of war. You don't. You don't feel that you're watching a war game. When you see American soldiers dead on Al Jazeera television, it's not like many Americans here think, that it's to make a point about the American soldiers. The last 4 days, I've seen graphic pictures of the injured, Iraqi injured. I saw a baby with her brains blown off. They do always show graphic pictures of the dead.
Well, Lama Sandoni, I want to thank you very much for being with us, independent journalist, analyst, comparing the Arab language press with the U.S. media. And yesterday, English Al Jazeera's website got off the ground, but we still have not been able to access it. It is not clear what is going on, whether it has been hacked or what. The website, english.aljazeera.net. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we go quickly to the United Nations, the invasion of Iraq moved into its second week, with the Security Council holding its first debate on the situation since the beginning of the invasion. At the request of the Arab League and non-aligned movement, the Security Council began an open meeting where some 70 countries are expected to take part. there was great opposition to the U.S.-led attack expressed. We're joined on the phone right now by Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who has written the book Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy in the September 11th Crisis. Very quickly, Phyllis, can you talk about what's happening at the U.S., at the United Nations, and also the information you have on countries being pressured by the U.S.?
The general atmosphere at the UN right now, Amy, is one of massive intimidation and fear. Countries are very afraid of the level of U.S. pressure, which is reaching unprecedented levels. In a recent letter that was sent, for instance, from the United States ambassador to the government of South Africa, there was a very direct threat made. It may be, we're not sure yet, it may be that similar letters were sent to many other countries. The relevant language says in this U.S. letter to South Africa, quote, given the current highly charged atmosphere, the United States would regard a General Assembly session on Iraq as unhelpful and as directed against the United States. Please know that this question, as well as your position on it, is important to the U.S. A very clear statement that any move by South Africa to support a move to get this issue into the General Assembly, which may be the next step, would be taken as a direct slap against U.S. interests and that South Africa would face punishment. Other countries are, of course, even more vulnerable because they're smaller, weaker, and more dependent on the United States. So it's in that context that the meeting was held at the Security Council level yesterday and will continue today. But it's very unlikely that any decision will come out of that meeting. It's unlikely there will be either a resolution or a presidential statement for the simple reason that countries are afraid. They're afraid of the consequences from the United States. The main debate that will take place starting tomorrow will be the debate over the nature of the UN's role in the question of a post-war or post-Saddam Hussein, depending on who you talk to, Iraq. And in this context, Colin Powell has made very clear that while he wants the UN to provide political cover for countries that he hopes will help pay for the humanitarian aid, something which is in fact the obligation solely of the United States as the occupying power, but nonetheless, Powell wants political cover from the UN, but has made clear that, in his words, we would not support handing over to the UN or someone designated by the UN to suddenly become in charge of this whole operation. Powell's statement yesterday in Congress made very clear, in his words again, we didn't take on this huge burden with our coalition partners not to be able to have significant dominating control over how it unfolds in the future. So the question of the willingness of the United States to allow a serious role for the United Nations has been made very clear.
Finally, as we move into the budget that has been proposed by Bush to cover this invasion, the coalition of, well, what you call the coerced, Phyllis.
We now call it the coalition of the killing.
Well, this coalition includes $8 billion to go towards allies like Jordan, Israel, Turkey, Pakistan, Egypt, Afghanistan, Philippines, Colombia. Can you talk about how this relates to the invasion?
Well, it's extraordinary because it's a moment, of course, when cities and states across the United States are facing massive deficits. The U.S. is cutting taxes from the wealthy and granting enormous new gifts to countries that are willing to sign on to be part of this so-called coalition, even if they don't participate militarily. The only military partners other than the U.K. are Australia, Poland, and Albania. You can imagine how important the military contribution of Albania and Poland are at this moment. But the notion that there will be $8 billion given out as bribes and gifts to countries that sign on flies in the face of the needs of Americans in terms of the needs of cities. This is a main part of the reason that the Cities for Peace campaign has reached as broadly as it has in cities across the United States, from New York to Chicago and Cleveland and Atlanta, all over the place, where people are saying, why should we be paying for an illegal war when we can't even get enough money to rebuild our schools and keep our hospitals?
Well, Phyllis, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. When we come back,
thank
we'll
you.
Look at the budget for war, and then we'll speak with Michael Franti. Stay with us.
We're living in a meantime. time and an aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time where violence blocks the summer shine. Lifetimes go by in a flash, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon, everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slave and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay? No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine, pass the buck or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation.
Rock the Nation. Michael Franti will be with us in a minute here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Military analysts are saying Bush administration's $75 billion budget request to fund the invasion of Iraq and cover related costs is just a down payment for what will most likely be a much costlier conflict. Bush's proposal includes $63 billion to fight the war, $8 billion in bilateral foreign aid to countries helping with the invasion and for reconstruction, and $4 billion for homeland security. We're going to take a look at what the war will really cost. We're going to start with Jason Nisse, who's business correspondent for the Independent newspaper in London, wrote an article earlier this month called The $800 Billion Conflict and A World Left Licking Its Wounds. $800 billion is certainly more than what we've heard. How did you come up with that figure, Jason Nisse?
Well, first off, just let me point out that I'm the business editor of The Independent on Sunday, which is the sister newspaper for The Independent. But just going into the detail of these figures, and we have to split this down, what Bush is talking about in the $75 billion that they've gone to Congress for is the cost, the direct cost of the war, assuming a conflict that lasts, we would estimate, no more than a month. We actually went to Congressional Budget Office estimates, which have a monthly cost of the actual fighting of the war at between $15 and $23 billion for direct costs. But the $62 billion also takes in occupation afterwards and various other related costs. Now, if the war goes on for longer than a month, then he's going to have to go back to Congress for more money because that's going to exceed his budget. The second off, the $8 billion of aid for friendly nations is minor compared to what they may be committing to. They did promise Turkey somewhere in the region of $30 billion. Now, obviously, because Turkey didn't allow American troops to be stationed there, they're not going to get this money. But I bet you anything, the Turkey will get something out of this. Plus, Jordan's asking for a couple of billion. Egypt's asking for $8 billion. Israel's asking for more than $10 billion because of the cost of the war. Now, if you tot all those up, you can get to $30 or $40 billion quite quickly. Then I'm not in a position to comment about the cost of homeland security, but there's a $1 billion in there for aid to starving people in Iraq. Now, already the estimate is that it'll cost more than $2 billion for humanitarian aid. So that's an underestimation. So all these figures are going to be bumped up from where this current estimate stands. So given that Larry Lindsey originally, who's the chief economic advisor to Bush, originally said $140 billion, I think that we should be seeing these the claims on Congress to go up.
And we should add that once he said that, he was forced out of the administration.
Yeah. Now, the other effect is what is going to happen to other parts of the world economy. Now, in the UK, Gordon Brown, our Chancellor, has just come up with the latest estimate of how much the war is going to cost UK directly, which is £3 billion, which is about $5 billion US. And that's just the direct cost. Now, plus there's an economic effect, and a lot of this rather depends on where the oil price is going to go. Now, the oil price was standing at $38 just before the war. Now it's come back in the $25 to $30 range because Saudi Arabia started pumping more oil to cover any shortfalls. Now, if it's going to be a long war, the oil price will go back up again, and that's going to depress the economy heavily. Now, nobody really knows how much, but there are estimates now going from quite a respected economist that it could depress world growth by up to 2% this year. Now, you multiply that, you're immediately at half a trillion dollars.
We're talking
get up to this $800 billion.
We're talking to Jason Nice, business correspondent for the Independent on Sunday in Britain. Greg Speeder on the line with us, executive director of National Priorities Project, a nonprofit which analyzes how federal policies affect ordinary Americans and cities and towns around the country. Greg, you've done some breakdowns on the implications of the Bush invasion budget for communities here at home. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we have. We've actually taken a look at how much a $100 billion war would cost each of the cities, many of the cities across the country. I just want to put something in perspective first and just say that this war is really going to be costly to cities that are falling apart at this point. Cities across the country are cutting back in school budgets. They're cutting back in fire and police. They're cutting back in libraries. And ultimately, it's the taxpayers of the city that are going to have to pay this. And, you know, Phyllis Bennis was talking about Cities for Peace, which is a group we've worked with. We've crunched the numbers for those cities to say how much they are paying. And I think the reason why 150-plus cities have said we don't want to go to war is because they realize that they can't address their needs here at home. Just to give you an example, we've done some work in New Haven, Connecticut. It's a city that has a child poverty rate of 33%. It's lost its manufacturing base, as have most cities across the country. So the jobs that they now have, service jobs, pay about a third less than manufacturing jobs. Most of the people who work there work on jobs that are not living wage jobs. Just in last November, New Haven, because of the state budget cuts, had to cut 100 employees from its budget, and as it put its new budget together in March, it had to cut 150 more jobs just from the school department. So you can see that it's really it's a city that's in crisis, as are most cities, and yet this war is going to cost this city $36 million. And I think what I'm concerned about is not only the cost of this war, but the cost of this whole policy of preemption, because I don't think that Iraq is just the only country that we're going after. As you listen to some of the media reports and read some of the other information, you see that this is that we have our intent to at least address Iran, North Korea, and Syria. Does that mean we're going to go to war with them? Is this going to be an ongoing war? We already spend 2.5 times on the military what we spend on education, housing, job training, food, nutrition, and welfare programs combined. So it's an incredibly expensive war in the Pentagon budget that is skyrocketing and will continue to skyrocket through the rest of this decade.
We're also hearing that the United Nations, the French Foreign Minister, Dominique de Villepin, said that the United Nations has to oversee the reconstruction of Iraq, but already the United States is doling out contracts to, for instance, Dick Cheney's quote-unquote former company Halliburton to put out oil fires in the south of Iraq, that it's unclear who set those oil fires, we have to say. And then secondly, a contract rewarded for the port of Umm Qasr. Seemingly, the United States is already going ahead with that.
Right. That's another problem that's happening. I mean, you know, there are corporations that are making money off of this, and yet, you know, ordinary people are having to pay for this. So I think we really need to take a look at, you know, who is making money and begin to question what kind of a policy this is. And it looks as though this is a war that the corporations are going to win and ordinary people are going to lose in.
Well, Greg Speeder, I want to thank you very much for being on with us. We will certainly continue to look at this issue, Executive Director of the National Priorities Project. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now into our last segment, looking at the invasion abroad and the invasion into the privacy of people here at home, and what is the connection. For nearly a decade, hip-hop artist and activist Michael Franti has been a leading progressive voice in music. He grew out of the Bay Area music and political scene of the 90s. In 1986, he founded the drum and bass duo The Beatniks, paving the way for his next musical endeavor, The Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopracy. His most recent musical project is the musical collective Spearhead, begun in 1994. And he's used his music to push social boundaries, speaks out against sexual violence, encourages his community to prevent the spread of HIV, has been very vocal in his opposition to war. And now it may be the reason why the government is looking at him and his group Spearhead. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what's been happening as you've been touring the country with songs like Bomb the World?
Well, we've been touring for the last year and a half performing that song, and everywhere we go, it gets standing ovations, people begin to cry. People are just very grateful to hear any voice that's out there right now who are speaking in support of peace and human rights.
If you could speak as clearly as you can, the phone is a little muffled sounding,
okay.
Michael. And so what's happened as you've been on this tour?
Well, what's happened most recently is we performed at a rally on March 15th in San Francisco. And the next day on the 16th, that rally was out here, and on the 16th on the East Coast, a band member of mine who prefers at this time to go unnamed, his mother received a visit from two plainclothes men from the military. And this band member of mine has a sibling who is in the Gulf. And they came in and talked to her and said, you know, you have a child who's in the Gulf, and you have a child who's in this band Spearhead, who's in part of the quote-unquote resistance, in their words. And they had pictures of us performing the day before at the rally. They had pictures of us performing at some of our annual concerts that we put on that are in support of peace and human rights. They had his flight records for the past several months. They had the names of everybody who works in my office, our management office, a guerrilla management. They had his checking account records. They asked his mother a lot of questions about, you know, where he was, what he was doing in this place, why he was going here. They confiscated his sibling's CD collection that they had brought over to listen to while they were in the Gulf. And basically were intimidating, told her which members of the press she could talk to and which members of the press that she should not speak to. And, you know, basically what this signals to me is that I don't feel like we're being particularly singled out or under any investigation for any activity, because all the activity that we do is very much above board, and all the events that photos were taken out were all public things that we're at. But what it does signal to me is that there's a lot of us who are now making a blip on the radar, you know, whether we're organizers at rallies, whether we're musicians, whether we're, you know, people who are speaking out, authors, writers, actors. And we're beginning to make little blips on the radar, and they're starting to pay attention and collect information about what's going on. You know, more important to me, or more important than me, you know, being a part of that, is the fact that our civil rights are being eroded across the board for every person. And for musicians in particular, it's a really hard time. Last week, our label received a letter, a mass email from MTV, instructing the fact that no videos could be shown that mentioned the word bombing or war. No videos could be shown that had protesters in it, any footage from military. They gave a list of prior videos that would not be shown, yet MTV has aired videos that show troops saying goodbye to their loved ones and going off to war in a very heroic fashion, and troops which are going to be coming home traumatized, wounded, and dead, and then be treated and thrown onto the scrap heap of veterans, as we've seen veterans be treated in this country. And at the Academy Awards, there was also letters and talk that went around saying, you know, not to speak out. Radio, mainstream radio, Clear Channel in particular, of course, has put the word out not to air songs that are in opposition to the war and support of peace. And meanwhile, our song Bomb the World, which you just put out, is now in heavy rotation on the top youth radio station in Australia and in Denmark, and it's expected to get added to a lot of other stations in other countries.
A few days ago, Jeremy Scahill and I were at the Ani DiFranco concert at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center to talk about Democracy Now! And the importance of independent media in a time of war, just before she went on. And the Clear Channel, which owns New Jersey Performing Arts Center, runs that venue, told her no political information could be given out and threatened, it seemed, the venue threatened to close down the concert if there was any political speech.
It's incredible. It's outrageous. And I think it's something that we all need to be aware of and you know, need to support the art, you know, whether it's music, whether it's films, whether it's dance performances or whatever. This is the last place, apart from, you know, Pacifica and a few other stations around the country, where these voices are being heard.
And Clear Channel, that runs 1,200 radio stations now,
yeah,
runs many of the big venues in this country.
Yeah, so it's important that we call those stations and we demand that these voices be heard.
Well, Michael Frani, I want to thank you for being with us as we go out with your voice with Bomb the World. That does it for the program. Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karenina Noguera, Noah Reibel, and Elizabeth Press, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. If you want a copy of today's program, video, you can call or audio 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Tonight, a big WBAI event in New York. For those of you who live around here, 7 o'clock at Riverside Church. Among those who will be there is Ozzie Davis and Harry Belafonte and Michael Moore and Reverend James Forbes and Herbert Daughtry and WBAI staff. Look forward to seeing you. Our website is democracynow.org. Bridge to Baghdad will play tonight on Channel 25 in New York. Conversation between Iraqi and U.S. students. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill. Many people are being arrested in New York right now. Thanks for listening.